welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, all those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers, and designers, those VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And you all know how much I love film and that I love to talk. So put the two together, and we get it. BTL Radio Show every Monday with plenty of interviews in between weeks. So it is a joy to talk about the who, what, where, when, why, and how, the sausage of movie making with these fantastic artisans. Now, it's another week of shining the spotlight on Dances with Films and a couple of the wonderful films and filmmakers in this year's festival. As last week, you heard from the fabulous Jay Silverman and his film Yale, starring Kevin Dunn. I hope you all made it out opening night of the festival on the 18th to see that, because it, and I can't wait. It's got to get a distribution deal soon. It just has to, so that everyone can see it, because it is fantastic. And I really hope all you General Hospital fans made it out there, to see Kathleen Gotti in a really fun role as an ex-stripper, in the film Yale. But as a reminder, Dances with Films runs through June 28th at the TCL Chinese Theater Complex in Hollywood. And a fun film that just screened two nights ago, Saturday night, a documentary, Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession. Put this on your radar, people. You do not want to miss this film. Be on the lookout for it. It is hilarious. It is eye-popping. It is kaleidoscopic. It is the story of the tiki culture that really started with the tiki mugs and all here in Southern California in Venice. So, you know, it's kind of cool that the film is having its LA premiere back where it all started, or its West Coast premiere back where it all started. It is a kick in the ass. I can't recommend it highly enough. I'm doing a separate standalone interview with the filmmaker and the subject of Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession. So listen for that. You might get a surprise episode of BTL Radio Show this week. But and there's still many more great films upcoming at DWF. Go to their website, danceswithfilms.com, and check it out. Tickets are still available for films, and it's great to support the indie community and indie filmmakers. But, and closing night film, Bandit, tickets are still available. My friend Tara McNamara is one of the producers on that film. And you know, every year, Tara and I always get together on the TCM Film Festival red carpet. So this year I might have to be on her red carpet, closing night of Bandit, but we'll see. But on to today's Behind the Lens. We're talking about two films at Dances with Films that you can catch tomorrow. One is tomorrow on the 23rd, and the other one is on June 27th. They are Hecla and The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg. Now, first up is my interview with co-writer, director Michael Glover-Smith and his very innovative, creative, fun, and very cool film, Hecla. Now, Hecla is a comedy drama about the emotional cost of pursuing a creative life, a.k.a. an actress. Set over the course of one hectic day in Chicago, this is a day in the life film. It explores how ambition, identity, and vulnerability collide when you're chasing something as personal and uncertain as an acting career. Our heroine, Hecla Goodmansdottir, beautifully played by Elizabeth Stamm. Hecla is a determined actress, and she races through auditions 4 in 1 day, breakups, self-doubt, risks her heart and career to claim her voice and step fully into the artist and woman she's meant to be. As I said, she goes on 4 auditions, gets new headshots, also does a video, tapes a video audition, and plays Lady Macbeth in a dive bar. Yes, folks, Macbeth in a dive bar. All while attempting to keep intrusive thoughts of a recently ended relationship at bay. And beneath the humor and the drama lies a story about the importance of showing up for yourself even when the world isn't clapping for you yet. Now, Hecla is written and directed by Michael Glover Smith. It's co-written by Elizabeth Stamm, who plays Hecla. It also stars Wendy Robbie, Mary Tilden, Brooklyn Hebert, and Sadie Raffi. But also, let me put these folks on your artisans' radar right now, because their work in Hecla is beyond outstanding and what really makes the film so inviting, so entertaining. And these people are the cinematographer Jose Perez, editor Eric Marsh, production designer Heather Kuhlman, and composer Trev Gibb. These magicians, and that's what they are. When you see Hecla, magicians is the word. They give Hecla the visual textures and excitement that we see on screen. Now, in this exclusive interview with Michael, we break down Hecla and all of its production elements. Now, there's a lot to see and unpack with this film, starting with its unique structure of 5 acts. And yes, we have title cards that set them off, Act 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Each act is named something like Mercury in Retrograde, and the Experimental Play, and Spring Day, which you're going to hear us talk about Spring Day. A Woman of No Importance, just an Act 5, which is simply Macbeth. It's fantastically structured. The titles are very distinct as to each one of the act, and the visual styles that unfold. And everything is inspired by both classic cinema and personal experiences. We go into the casting. As we break down A Day in the Life of Hecla. And I have to say, each one of these acts is structured and filmed, so it can stand alone as a short film. You could have 5 short films here. Smith collaborated very closely with lead actress Elizabeth Stamm, who co-wrote the script. And Michael's the first one to give credit for the film's visual impact to cinematographer Jose Perez, who balances black and white and color beautifully. And, of course, to production designer Heather Kuhlman. Now, the movie uses mostly black and white visuals, with bursts of vibrant color that reflect Hecla's inner world, such as when she's on an audition, she's reading a part, but in her mind, she's seeing something totally different than what might be on the page. So there's a lot of humor there, and the inspiration for a lot of these visuals and Hecla's mind visions are inspired by classic Hollywood and French New Wave. Eric Marsh's editing is just exemplary because of the rapier nature that he has to have with the speed at which Hecla's running through her day. And then that's aided by a dreamlike score from Trev Gibb. I love this score, and it just enhances the film's tone. And, of course, we get into the transitional shots, how we go from Act 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. The film's opening, a very ambiguous ending, and this very collaborative, fast-paced production process. Michael and his crew moved at, like Speedy Gonzalez on this one, I got to tell you. So, take a listen, as Michael Glover Smith talks about the very fun and very creative Hecla.
So nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you too, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing well this morning in Chicago, Illinois.
Well, this is quite a film that you have delivered here with Hecla.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much.
I didn't know what to expect with this film. Number one, I was fascinated.
Okay. Yeah.
I love your structure, your acts, the way you've broken this into acts, and the titles you've come up for each act is so fun. Mercury in Retrograde, Retrograde Experimental Play, Spring Day. Spring Day had me in stitches, that entire sequence.
Oh, I'm so glad.
We get Act 4, A Woman of No Importance. The whole idea of Hecla going back to the bookstore, whose bathroom she just used to put on makeup, put on nail polish, change her clothes, to go back and spend a dollar just to be a patron, was hilarious. And, of course, we get Macbeth as our Act 5. Each one is so well contained as its own chapter. You could lift any one of these out and make them their own little short film.
That's exactly right.
And I really love that you structured it that way with your different chapters or different acts, but you followed through on the concept.
Mm-hmm.
So everything feels connected as one big life in the day of Hecla.
Yes.
Or day in the life of Hecla. But each will stand on its own.
Right. Well, Macbeth itself has 5 acts. So that was sort of where I got the idea for the structure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've seen other films, as I'm sure you have, where they get broken into chapters or acts, and they'll usually do like 3.
Right.
So I'm watching, and we got 3, and then we got 4, and it's only at 4 is only at the 50-minute mark. I'm going, okay, we got another half hour. He's not giving us a half an hour act here. It's not going to happen. So then when we got Act 5, I'm like, oh, this makes much more sense here. Where did the idea of Hecla arise? Where did you come up? It's such a novel concept. The day in the life of an actress, a wannabe, so to speak, quote unquote, wannabe actress, is nothing new. But
yes.
A day in the life with this much detail to this extent and with this much haphazardness at times in Hecla's mind is just fantastic. So I'm curious, where did this idea come from?
Well, this film had an unusually long gestation process because I started writing it in 2016.
Oh, wow.
It's my 5th feature film, and all 5 of my films are micro-budget films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the budget, I've never had a budget higher than $100,000. But my second feature was called Mercury in Retrograde.
Right.
And the audition that she does at the beginning of the film is literally a scene from that film.
Okay.
So... When I cast Mercury in Retrograde, that was my first time going through a traditional audition process with a casting director, using a casting agency, videotaping all of the actors who were auditioning. And I was absolutely fascinated by the process. And so I immediately started brainstorming ideas for a script about an actor who would go through that process over and over again. And I started, this was before I ever met Elizabeth Stamm, who ended up playing the part. Originally, the script was not about the character Hecla. It was about another character named Michaela, who had a very different personality than Hecla. But she went on 4 auditions, and then she played Lady Macbeth at a dive bar the same evening because I had a friend named Claire Cooney, a wonderful actress, who was actually the casting director for Mercury in Retrograde. And she told me that, you know, four auditions was the most she had ever gone on in a single day. And she also acted in, not Macbeth, but a production of As You Like It that was put on in a bar in Chicago. And so I was initially thinking about casting her in this role. And years went by. I made other films instead. And I always kind of tinkered with the Hecla script. And then in the year 2021, I made a film called Relative, which is the last feature I made before Hecla. And I worked with Elizabeth on that film, and she played a character named Hecla. So technically, Hecla is a spinoff of my previous film because she's playing the same character.
Mm-hmm.
But Relative was a large ensemble comedy drama with a lot of actors in it who have roles that are basically the same size. And after I worked on Relative, Elizabeth and I got along like a house on fire. And a lot of critics reviewed Relative and said that Elizabeth gave the best performance in that film, that it was a scene-stealing performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started talking to her about if she would want to revisit this character in a different film and expand the role so that she was the lead. And she was very excited about the possibility of doing that. So then I took this old script about a character named Michaela, and I rewrote it extensively so that it was about Hecla.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the years, Elizabeth, and then I asked Elizabeth to co-write it with me because she and I became friends, and I realized this is a very different type of movie than any that I've made before, in the sense that all of my previous films have ensemble casts, and Hecla is a one-woman show. And so I thought to myself, if this movie is going to work at all, Elizabeth really needs to feel like she has complete ownership of the character.
Mm-hmm.
So then I asked her if she wanted to rewrite the script, and she agreed, and she had never written anything before, but in real life, she is the funniest person I know. Her sense of humor is wonderful. She's very charismatic. She has a very exuberant personality. And so I just thought her natural sense of humor and her natural intelligence would lend itself to this project if she rewrote it. And she did, and it was a wonderful experience because I said, look, you don't feel like you have to do too much. You know, if there's something you don't want to say, just delete it. If there's something you want to add, just add it. And then if you don't want to make any changes, you don't have to. And she loved having the freedom to, you know, do as much or as little as she wanted. And honestly, asking her to write the film with me was the best decision I made because she didn't make a whole lot of changes, but the ones she did, I think, really elevated the entire project.
I am guessing here that your work with your DP, with Jose Perez, did not begin until you had the entire script on the page, because this is very clearly your visual tonal bandwidth and your visual grammar are dependent upon where Hecla is within the course of her day and within her mind.
Yep, that's exactly right.
As to when you introduce color. Sometimes it's just a quick flash. Maybe it's just 24 frames. and it gives
that's
us
right.
a tiny flash. And I found the visual grammar and the visual tonal bandwidth so enticing, Michael. Very unexpected. You never know when color is going to pop up. And when we get color, it's very, very vibrant. Cinemascopic, Kodachrome, almost.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that. And it speaks volumes as to Hecla, who she is and what's going on in that head of hers. Because clearly this is how she sees herself when she's doing auditions. That this is how she's going to do this role, even though that may not be what the role should be. And of course, it's larger than life. It's brighter than life. It's the color is more kaleidoscopic than life. And it catches you every time. And you just go, wow, it's eye popping. Talk to me about designing this visual structure.
Yes, well, I have to give a lot of credit to Jose. I think he's one of the best cinematographers in Chicago. And you're right. I didn't hire him until the script was complete.
Mm-hmm.
And but he and I, we visited all of the locations in advance. We did extensive technical scouts of the places where we were going to be shooting, and we spent a lot of time talking about the visual grammar of the film. And my original thought was to shoot the entire movie in black and white. I'm a film studies instructor.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do for a living. Most of the films that I show in my classes were made in the early 20th century through the mid 20th century. I'm really influenced by classic Hollywood and also the French New Wave.
Okay.
And so, I also have to give credit to my production designer, a woman named Heather Kuhlman, who I think is a genius. She was the one who had the idea of doing the color sequences, because she basically said, Mike, Hecla is the most colorful character ever. You have to find a way to get some color into this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized she was right, because Hecla does have a larger than life, you know, comedic persona. And I thought, she's right. I don't want the whole movie to be in color, but if it's mostly in black and white, and then every once in a while, we have a kind of fantasy cutaway sequence,
mm-hmm.
you know, where we show what's going on in Hecla's brain while she's auditioning, that will make the color more impactful. And we can really kind of go over the top in terms of using color in a way that's painterly. And we can, you know, design sets and design the costumes in a way that, like, corresponds to what's happening in Hecla's inner world.
Right.
And if it's, you know, mostly black and white, and then we cut to those sequences, the color is going to be even more, it's going to pop more, it's going to be almost shocking to the viewer. Because I feel like when we watch movies, we take color for granted. You know, if the whole movie's in color, we don't think about it. We just think, oh, this is the way the world is. But when you watch The Wizard of Oz, you know, and it begins in sepia, and then all of a sudden it goes into color, it's really shocking. And so I wanted my film to have that same kind of quality as the beginning of Wizard of Oz.
Well, you definitely achieved that. And I think it speaks volumes as to who Hecla is.
Yes.
It really speaks to your main character. And of course, because of this stylization that you have done and the visual grammar you and Jose have done, and which, by the way, I have to say, Jose's black and white photography is stunning. You've got a scene at the 40-minute, 23-second mark that mm-hmm. is to die for. With light.
Refresh my memory.
There's a profile there, and it's really dark on the one side, on the left side of the screen, and light is shining forward. So it's almost like it could be a silhouette.
Yeah.
But for the contrast of the dark and light, I am in love with Jose's work. And like you, old films, classic films, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. When we get color. Yeah, I love Technicolor. Norma Kalmus and her Technicolor. Love Technicolor, but black and white, and that is the hallmark of an incredible cinematographer when they can light for black and white, because it becomes more metaphoric and adds such a deeper layer to the story, especially from a metaphoric standpoint. And that's exactly what Jose does here. And then to give us the eye-popping color, and it's always straight, full on, full stage, or full grass, depending on what act we're in and where we are in Hecla's mind. Just beautiful. And yes, I'm glad you brought up Heather. I have Heather written in my notes, blocked out with a big block around it in really big letters. Production design, Heather Kuhlman. Her production design, especially Act 4, the production design, a woman of no importance for that audition scene, that whole stage, the setting behind it, is glorious. And we see it in black and white, so there's negative space. But then we get color. And we get to see really all the detail that she has put in, while Jose keeps the light more subdued. So we still have negative space, but in color, but it lets us see all the detail that Heather has put in.
Right. You completely got it.
So I am then to see what Heather does with the medieval outdoor section and that makeshift stage and all. Just beautiful, beautiful work on... Every level.
I'm so happy that you're saying all this, because, you know, we put so much work into the visual design of the film. And I think a lot of people, you know, they only want to talk about character and story. And I think the style of the film, of course, always is in service to the character.
Right.
But I think a lot of people don't really notice the details. And the way the sets that she's on become in the fantasy sequences become more and more minimal until the last one, that she's outdoors and, you know, there's no set except for the purple curtains.
Right.
There is no stage except for nature. And then in contrast to that, her makeup actually becomes more elaborate every time you see her with, you know, darker lipstick.
The pinks get darker.
The pinks get darker and, you know, her jewelry becomes more elaborate and more sort of fantastical. You know, we had a lot of fun sort of showing how she evolves over the course of the film. And I think also I'm really happy you like the black and white, because that's one aspect of the film that is not entirely realistic. I think our film is realistic in terms of what happened, in terms of what the kind of audition she goes on. I mean, that's all based on the real life of a Chicago actor. For a Chicago actor to audition for, you know, plays, a film, a commercial in a single day, that is very realistic. But the spaces in which she auditions are deliberately unrealistic, because they're, in real life, you know, auditions typically happen in boring spaces.
Yes.
Rooms with white walls, overhead lighting, usually fluorescent lights. And I didn't want to do that. So I wanted an expressionistic style for the audition sequences, even in black and white.
Yeah.
In terms of what the spaces looked like, and so you know, that was to me, that's the whole fun of making a movie, is creating that visual design.
Oh well, it's like I just think back on it, and I'm thinking at Act Two, the experimental play. And then she's like, her costume, she's like a little girl in a fairy story. It's all fantasy,
right.
And it's fluffy pink and all of this. We go into spring, Act Three, a spring day, and we see all of her prep in the bookstore bathroom, including putting on nail polish, which I found extremely humorous, because she goes to the taping lady first, the taping facility, and says, "Oh, I'll be right back." Okay, then she runs down the street. She goes in the bookstore, goes in the bathroom, changes her clothes, fixes her hair, which was actually looked combed for one of the first times, puts on nail polish, and I'm thinking, this is more than a minute. What the hell is she doing? Then she runs back, and then we get her spring day douche tape as a cowgirl spinning a rifle like a majorette. With sparkles and fringe and oh my God. And you keep giving, you know, you give us so much visual eye candy here, Michael. I got to tell you. But this is where Heather's work is so important. But then building on all of this to get this great effect of the color popping up and then leaving and even in the same scene.
Yeah.
The first audition, and she's there with the guy that she doesn't like, and yeah, she gets into a huge heated argument for the audition, but we go into color, then we come out of color, then we go into color, then we come back out of color within the same confrontation between these two. So this falls on Eric, your editor. This falls on Eric.
Exactly. Yeah.
How challenging was the edit on this one for you and Eric, Michael?
It was probably the most challenging editing job that we've ever had. But I'm very fortunate in that I have an extremely close relationship with him. He edited both of my previous two features, as well as two short films. So we have a very close working relationship, and I think, you know, I don't like to shoot a lot of coverage. I shoot very little. You know, this is a micro-budget film, and we shot it in 10 days, which is not a lot of time. So we do a lot of preparation in order to know what we're going to do when we arrive on set. But having said all that, because there are these fantasy sequences, I left myself room to play around with that in the editing room because we didn't know exactly how we were going to use them. We, you know, and I wanted to use those fantasy scenes in a different way every time. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't want it to become predictable what you were going to see. So the first fantasy sequence where she's pulling the daggers out of the heart costume, you know, I said, let's put that entire sequence because she reads through the scene twice with her scene partner, let's put it in between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like that shows that she's getting into a zone where she's going to do well. She's going to do better the second time than she did the first. And then the next sequence, the experimental play, we hit on the idea of showing almost subliminal flashes of the kind of fairy tale set.
Yes.
With the campfire and the stars. And we had a lot more footage. I mean, we could have used more of that, but I thought it'll be really effective if, while she's telling the monologue about the blue eye, we just see these brief flashes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third sequence, Spring Day, we talked about possibly cutting to her in the cowgirl uniform, you know, while she was reading the commercial the first time. And I think we might have even tried it, but the monologue is actually pretty short. And so then we hit upon the strategy of just showing the entire thing again the second time. And I loved doing that because I thought it's almost like it feels like what you're seeing the second time could be the commercial itself.
Yeah.
You know, like, are we flashing forward into the future? Like, she got the commercial, and this is what it is. And then for the last audition, I wanted it to feel like the indoor sequence and the outdoor sequence were kind of in dialogue with mm-hmm. each other, or like she was in dialogue with herself, where you see her sort of completing sentences, you know, inside versus outside.
Yeah. As I'm watching this, all I kept thinking is, oh my God, he must have spent 6 months editing this thing. It's because of the precision, Michael.
Yeah.
It's very precise in this cutting, and it needs to be.
Yeah. Credit to Eric. All credit to Eric Marsh. You know, he does something else that is extremely helpful. He picks up the footage every day from our set, and he starts cutting immediately. So on the after the first day of shooting, he comes to set, he picks up a drive, all the footage on a hard drive, he takes it home, he starts editing that night. So on the second day, he's literally sending me the footage via email that he's cut from the day before. And so I start showing that to the actors on the set. I say, hey, you guys want to see what we did yesterday? And then that gets everybody really excited.
Yes.
Because they can see that it's coming together. And so by the time we're done shooting, it's, you know, he already has a lot of footage, you know, put into the timeline.
Mm.
And so we shot this film last August, and which is, you know, not that long ago.
Yeah, this is a short turnaround.
Oh, we premiered in March. It was, you know, it's crazy. But you know, we can only move that fast because we have a lot of prep, and also, you know, I have a close relationship with all of these people. So we have a kind of shorthand communication with each other.
Yeah, which is so important and so key. Now, something that I really appreciated you and Jose doing as you're shooting, the transition shots, I use that loosely in quotes, where Hecla is running from point A to point B. I love how these are shot with Jose behind her. So mm-hmm. we're seeing her back as she's running forward, running down the street, running over the bridge. I really like that. We're not alongside of her. We're not watching her face as she's... It's not a Bridget Jones moment where we see her walking through the crowd. The camera is right there, just shy of being sitting on her shoulder.
Right, right.
I really love that.
And she's also running.
Yes.
You know, she's always... her life is... We spend a lot of time talking about that because the whole idea is she's a chaotic person. And, you know, we talked about how she needs to have a lot of bags.
Yep.
Because she's not going to be able to go back home. She has to change, you know, where she can. And she has to, you know, she's got to have scripts with her. She's got to have makeup. She's got to have her coffee mug. And she's got to have a backpack. And so those were some of the earliest conversations we had, was about how I wanted to be following her as she was either walking fastly or running.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was always just a little bit late, or was worried about being late, and having the camera behind her and having it be handheld, I thought really would be a good way to capture that.
Handheld was a brilliant way to go. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, handheld doesn't work. Like what I was saying earlier about color, I mean, handheld doesn't work if you overdo it.
Right.
So that was sort of the idea, was the interior scenes were going to be locked down for the most part, and then we were going to be handheld when she's outside going through the streets.
You have balanced this so perfectly, Michael. So perfectly. One thing I do have to mention, my favorite line in the whole film, where Hecla is explaining things and she goes, I'm too selfish for a relationship. I was like, oh God, I love that. I love that. That was, very few people, especially women, will ever admit that.
Right.
I've always admitted that. I cracked up. I thought that was great. But I do want to ask you about your music and what you were looking for with the score and what you got from Trev.
Yes. Well, Trev, again, is someone I've collaborated with a lot over the years. I've known him for decades, although I've never met him in person. He lives in Newcastle, England. And so our collaboration is completely online. But he and I also have an unusual way of working, which is he writes and records the score before we shoot the movies.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And so what he read the script for this probably a year or a year and a half before we started shooting. And he would compose, you know, pieces and then upload them to a drive online. And I would listen and I would give him feedback. And oftentimes I would tell him that I wanted the score to be weirder. You know, I wanted it to have, I wanted it to be kind of electronic and dreamy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started moving more in that direction. And by the time we were shooting, I had a lot of music. I had all these folders, you know, with all these songs in them. And we were playing a lot of that music on the set to kind of set the tone.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was so helpful. And again, that also makes the editing go fast when you know what the music is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not having to wait on a composer to, you know, to score it. We were putting the music against those scenes, again, as soon as we started editing. And I think Trev is phenomenally talented, but if you listen to his music, he's a singer-songwriter. I mean, a lot of what he does is more in the folk vein or in the folk rock vein. And I was asking him to compose a lot of music that is more sort of synthesizer-heavy, instrumental pieces. And I think he really loved, and of course, all of that, again, kind of corresponds to Hecla's inner life.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to kind of draw us into her inner world as she's traversing the city. And I just kept using words like ethereal and dreamlike.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he came up with. And I just couldn't be happier with how it turned out.
The score is Hecla. It's her.
It's another aspect of her.
But you hear it and you think Hecla.
Right. Exactly.
Before I have to let you go, we've got about 5 minutes here before the phone will ring again. I have to ask you the ending. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. No spoilers, but what a character shift as she concludes her performance in Macbeth in the bar and she gets into an Uber.
Yeah.
What? I did not expect that.
Good.
A complete tonal shift.
Yes.
Did you ever question going that route?
No. I mean, I like endings that are open, and I like endings that are ambiguous. I wanted her performance of Macbeth to feel triumphant. And I wanted you to feel the joy that she felt performing live.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's why she does what she does.
To get the
feedback of the crowd. I mean, she even says to Tyler early on, you know, I need to hear some applause before I scream. And so in the end, she gets the applause that, you know, she's been craving. But I also wanted there to be a feeling of sadness in the final scene when she's in the Uber, because her performance is done. You know, she says it's one night only. It's one show only. It's not like it's a play that's going to run for 2 months and she's going to get to do it again. She doesn't know what tomorrow brings. And, you know, she auditioned for four different things, and she's just waiting to hear back about them. And it's a lot of fun doing Q&As for this movie, because audience members have strong opinions about, you know, whether she got any of these roles, which ones she did get, which ones she didn't get. But, so, you know, I think she herself feels sad because she doesn't know what's next. And I think that's very, again, realistic for the life of an actor.
Well, if she gets if one of these auditions pans out, I really hope it's the Spring Day Douche.
I hope so. Well, that's probably the one that's going to pay the best.
That's what I'm thinking. When they can when in your head you're imagining they have all this money for that elaborate a costume.
Right.
And even a rifle to twirl and the fancy cowboy boots. No, no, no. I think that we're going to hope that she gets that one.
Yes.
Oh, Mike. Michael, this has been so much fun talking with you about Hecla. I can't wait for audiences to see it here in L.A. at Dances with Films in a couple weeks.
I'm so excited to come out. And Elizabeth is coming out with me, so I think we're going to have a ball.
I think you're going to have a blast. Now, when is the film screening at Dances with Films?
It's Tuesday night, June 23rd at 6:30 p.m.
Michael, this has been such a joy getting to talk with you about Hecla. I'd like to see another chapter in Hecla's life.
We're not ruling out another film.
Well, you make another one, and I will be there watching it.
Oh, thank you so much, Debbie. It was a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate your enthusiasm. And
thank you so much, Michael. And maybe I will even see you at the fest.
I would love that. Please introduce yourself if you're there and you see me.
If I am there, I will lasso you. And yes, I promise.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And that was Michael Glover Smith talking about Hecla. And the film has its West Coast premiere at Dances with Films tomorrow, Tuesday, June 23rd at 6:30 p.m. Tickets are still available. Buy them online. Go to the Man's Chinese 6 upstairs from the Big Chinese Theater. Buy them at the door. You will not be disappointed by this film. Now, shifting gears, and I do mean shifting, we move into a medical legal tale told from a very unique perspective, that of the medical expert. Yeah, you've seen medical legal and medical stuff told by the patients, by the doctors, by lawyers, but this is from the POV of the medical expert. The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg is inspired by a true story, and one that involves greed, power, lies, tragedy, danger, and death. And for this real story, it comes from none other than our writer-director, Doug Bremner. Dr. Doug Bremner. Doug is a professor of psychiatry and a medical researcher. He did brain imaging research on the effects of Accutane. I think a lot of you probably remember the Accutane lawsuits. The front and center in the news for quite a while. But he did research on the effects of Accutane on the brain, and as a result became an expert witness in a multi-district litigation related to depression and suicide in teenagers who had taken the drug. Unlike most research, the research into Accutane was funded by private donations from affected families, families where their teens had committed suicide. Now, The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg is a fictionalized story with elements of truth. Now, in reality, the plaintiffs settled directly with the drug manufacturer. And a condition of that settlement was that they couldn't talk about the settlement. There was a confidentiality clause with each person that settled. Now, for the fictional, and, you know, Doug is calling on his own experience as a medical expert witness in those cases through depositions and getting qualified as an expert, which is a pain in the butt. I didn't think that I'd be talking about a film and have to put my legal hat on again. And for those of you that may know, that don't know, yeah, I spent over 27 years in the legal profession, graduated law school, took the bar, and walked away from law and devoted myself 100% full-time to film and criticism and journalism. Because of the corruption of attorneys that I saw over the course of my time working in the legal profession. So it's always nice when I get to pop my legal hat on once in a while, which I usually end up doing a lot when it comes to my condo in the HOA. But I digress. In series like Dope Sick and some other films that have come out, yeah, that's always fun. But yeah, I had to put my legal hat back on for this one. So I appreciate what Doug has done, and I understand what he went through to fictionalize this tale. Now, yes, there are plenty of elements of truth, but he has to focus on, you've got to find a through line for this story, and you have to make it interesting and appealing. It can't be filled with legal jargon or medical jargon from beginning to end, especially when you don't have George Clooney or Noah Wiley delivering the dialogue. But this story is basically after the death of her son, Amanda Bellaconda seeks the help of Dr. Jack Forteo to understand why teenagers are suddenly taking their own lives after taking a medication for acne. They gave it the this drug is the goose that keeps laying golden eggs. Corinoderm is the name of this drug in the film. And yeah, like the fable, the goose that laid the golden egg. This drug was bringing in $1 billion a year for the Renzon Pharmaceutical Company. Now, when Dr. Forteo sees a potentially lethal side effect of this blockbuster acne pill, Renzon doesn't hesitate to pull out the stops with personal attacks and accusations of fraud, bringing Forteo's marriage and career to the brink of destruction. With nothing left to lose, Dr. Forteo goes on a journey to revisit a tragedy from his own past. And when he unearths painful secrets and deceptions that parallel those he's discovered in the pharmaceutical company, his voyage of self-discovery gives him the strength to resume his struggle, leading to the ultimate conclusion of this story. The goose laid, it's very powerful watching this, and I have to give kudos to Andy Evans, who plays Dr. Jack Forteo. He brings so much empathy, compassion, and also trepidation and confusion to the role. You can understand why he's reluctant to be an expert witness. And I've seen this firsthand with doctors that had never been expert witnesses, and you want them to testify. And sometimes it's very difficult to convince them because of situations like this with personal attacks and accusations of fraud and whatnot from opposing counsel or manufacturers or device manufacturers. So you got to give it up for Andy Evans in here. But while the film is written by and directed by Doug Bremner, pay attention to who it's produced by. Executive producers include Neil Shulman, MD, Raymond Shinazi, PhD, and Patch Adams, MD. Now, those of you of my generation, you may remember a little film a couple decades ago starring Robin Williams as Patch Adams. and the founding of his Gesundheit Institute, because he believed that laughter was truly the best medicine. So it's kind of cool to see Patch Adams on board here as an executive producer of The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg. Now, in addition to Andy Evans, as Dr. Jack Forteo, we've got David DeVries as defense counsel, and he is a kick in the ass. Hannah Fireman, Sean Sharma, Carolyn Avery Granger, and one of the best villainous plaintiff attorney, defense attorneys I've ever seen, Niecy Woods, who is just killer as Crystal Watson. Wow. She carries a mean and hateful look on her face the entire film. And it works. Scares the bejeebus out of Dr. Forteo. In this exclusive conversation with writer-director Dr. Doug Bremner, discussing The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg, we start with the film's unique perspective, that of an expert witness in a medical legal case. And from there, the conversation covers the importance of legal accuracy, medical accuracy, but with the legal accuracy, especially regarding reference to seminal cases on expert testimony, expert witnesses, the Daubert case and Fry. I remember when the Daubert case was handed down. It's on a federal level. Fry standard is at state levels, but Daubert was at the federal level, and it changed malpractice cases, product liability cases, and made it very difficult in many instances and really set standards high for experts. And there's also very strong multidimensional female characters here. Now, Doug gives us great detail about the casting process, location challenges, a lot of locations, and the collaborative work with his cinematographer, Jim McKinney, and his editor, Christina Cromer, to achieve the authentic visuals. And he gives us some great behind-the-scenes anecdotes. I kid you not. He explains how real-life experiences as an expert witness inform the script and the character development, and describes the editing, scoring, and sound design process. This is Doug's second film, so he's still a newbie when it comes to understanding production logistics and what things like ADR, Foley are. But it's interesting to hear him talk about this and how he embraced all of this in bringing this film to life. And the film is a standout, and he's very proud of this, for the realistic portrayal of courtroom dynamics and for showcasing the pressures faced by expert witnesses. So this really gives a fresh take on typical legal or medical dramas. So take a listen as writer-director and doctor and researcher Doug Bremner talks about The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg. Hi, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well.
I'm very excited to talk to you about The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg.
Oh, good. Did you watch it?
Of course I did. I wouldn't be talking to you if I hadn't. That is my rule. My rule.
Yeah.
I must see a film. I don't talk to anybody unless I've seen the film. And I have to say that never in my life did I expect to be watching this film and hear the Daubert case brought up, the Kumho tire case brought up, the Fry case. I spent over 27 years in law and utilized these cases all the time, especially in products liability cases and medical malpractice.
Oh, so this is your backyard then. So, I mean, actually, it's interesting. The whole Daubert angle made it that we had to base it in New Jersey. It couldn't be in Florida, in Georgia, because Daubert doesn't apply in Georgia. There's only like, and then the line where they say there's only five states that you have Daubert, and one of them is, you know, New Jersey. That if we had faked that, then someone like you would know that that was
I knew how Daubert was going to play into this by not being applicable at the state level, and that they would fall back on, they'd have to fall back on Fry and Kumho and allow him to testify.
Another thing I wanted to do was to have the woman character not just be a victim, but, you know, kind of have this arc where she becomes empowered with information. So, like, the very kind of an earlier version of the script, she was a nurse and she was in a hospital, and then someone played a trick on her and it showed that she's gullible. And then she kind of gets burned by, I mean, the ultimate thing is that she gets burned by the medical system because her son, she trusts this drug that her son takes, and then it kills him. And so then I wanted her to demonstrate her kind of taking charge of the situation, but she's the one that figures out the Daubert versus Fry thing.
I love the fact that you make Amanda a strong character. I love the fact that you've got Niecy Woods as Crystal Watson. And boy, she plays Crystal with the biggest chip on her shoulder, and it's like she wants to show everybody up that she's a female attorney and she's going to beat everybody down. You can tell, you can see the hatred that Crystal has.
That's the way it is. Like one of the attorneys I went up against, she would collect like trophies, like, you know, that symbolize how she has taken down a great scientist, you know?
Yeah. I know a lot of guy attorneys that used to do that, but no, I know some female attorneys. How often do you testify as an expert, Doug?
I've probably been named about 20 times. And then you end up getting deposed, you know, mm-hmm. I've been in a courtroom. Well, with the Accutane thing, I was deposed like 18 times. In fact, one of my blog posts I wrote on the Huffington Post, it was called Deposition X, and I stopped counting the number of depositions because I didn't want to know when the 13th one was, because I was kind of superstitious.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
So they really pulled up the stops. I mean, it was pretty intimidating. You know, the lawyer, I mean, the one mistake I made with Niecy, as I said, just turn it down by 5%. And then that just threw her off. I was like, don't listen to me anymore. Go back to what you were doing. You know?
Oh, my God. Yeah, she's the kind of attorney you love to hate. And you did an amazing job casting David DeVries as Red Leghorn, playing opposite her. Because he's got he's got drive, but he's got that down-home, folksy, aw shucks that's appealing to people. Especially when you see somebody opposite them who just has a nasty, mean look on their face all the time. So these little details really, as many times as I've been in courtrooms, really stood out for me, and I commend you on them. But now I'm curious, what led you... You wrote the book, The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg. What made you decide to turn this into a film?
Well, it was originally, so I started out, I was friends with Neil Shulman, who's kind of hangs out with Patch Adams and stuff, and they do similar kind of Dr. Clown stuff, and he wrote the screenplay for Doc Hollywood, which had Michael J. Fox.
Mm-hmm.
I had been writing nonfiction, you know, for the general public, kind of health-related things. That's how I met Neil. And I was telling him the story about my expert witness story, and he said, wow, that sounds like it could be a good movie. So that was the first screenplay that I wrote. And then when I didn't sell the screenplay right away, I thought, well, I'll turn it into a book I have something to give people or whatever. And then I got an agent for the book who made me turn it into a nonfiction book. So the book itself is nonfiction. But I kind of like, there's so much in it that is, you know, is really better on the screen, you know, because there's so many dramatic elements, mm-hmm. and the courthouses and everything, you know, it's really, you know, a book I don't think does this justice. And the guy that played the lead, he read the book, and he said he liked the screenplay better, so... I think it just comes across better as a film than as a nonfiction book for this particular one.
actually, it's you have very dramatic visual moments in here, Doug. One that really stands out is after the judge rules that Dr. Forteo can testify as an expert witness, not going to preclude his testimony or disqualify him. And you have the courtroom filled with people that have lost a loved one to this drug, and they hold up the photos. That is such an incredible moment in the film. And if this were in a book, be it fiction or nonfiction, that will never have the same impact. Never have the same impact.
And that was actually not in the script. It was not even my idea. It was this woman who kind of came in, and she had a lot of bad ideas, but that was like one good idea. And then I had to, so she was changing the script, and then I kind of went back and was changing it back because people were saying, hey, the script is getting, it got worse. But that one, I she was like this sort of born again Christian, and she was taking out all the kind of inappropriate, you know, interactions between the characters. But that one was a good idea, and I decided to keep that in, and it was kind of risky, you know, but it did work. And you could tell, like, the extras, you know, we asked the extras to bring in a photo of, like, a teenage child or family member.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had something that they were kind of emotionally relating to, you know, whatever it was. You know, I mean, I doubt that they all had teenagers that killed themselves, but there was like, kind of an emotion there that you could feel as they raised those pictures up in the air. It's pretty awesome, actually.
That's an incredible moment in the film. I have to tell you, Doug, that really stands out for me. Just wonderful. But talk to me about, once you had the script and you put together your cast, and it's a wonderful cast. We do have a doctor we get to hate, the dermatologist, sneaky bitch that she is. So we have an attorney we can hate. We have a doctor who is untrustworthy that we can hate. We have a sympathetic and intelligent mother who has lost a child. We have some defense attorneys who are wonderful. We have hospital administrators, university administrators, who are as you would expect them to be. So you have all of these elements here. Then you've got to sit down with your cinematographer, Jim McKenney, and figure out how you're going to shoot this. What were the considerations that you and Jim had from a directorial and cinematographic standpoint in designing the visuals of this film?
Well, so Jim and I are friends. He was the cinematographer on my first film. His son was like friends with my son, kind of thing, in Decatur, Georgia. So I know him really well. I mean, the big challenge is sort of, you know, he's really busy. He works for, you know, the stuff like The Walking Dead kind of thing. And you know how these people are. It's like if they have another job that comes up, which often comes up at the last minute, then they're on that job and it's hard to get a hold of them. So my big thing was just trying to get him to the actual sites. One of the things that happened was that, there's counties all around Atlanta that have these historic courthouses. And so we were trying to get these historic courthouses that are not too far away, but that they were kind of older courthouses that would be available because they're not used for daily work as much anymore. And so there was a rapper who kind of did a rap video where he was saying, like, you know, F the police or something in this music video in a courtroom, which kind of put a damper on the whole courtroom thing. So one of our courtrooms backed out, and then we had one in Cartersville, and then I got the second one in Gainesville. But some of the other producers say, no, it's too far away. You know, it's not going to work for various reasons. They want to do it in the studio. But, like, Jim really kind of felt strongly that it had to be in this particular courtroom, in a real courtroom. And so he and I kind of both put our foot down, and at the last minute we ended up being able to go to that courtroom, which was the initial trial, which was in Hall County Courthouse in Gainesville. some of the other things, you know, we had plans to do things like we wanted to go to Jersey City and film looking across the Hudson River at New York and Manhattan, and then have the dialogue between the doctor and the mother. But stuff like that, we just sort of ran out of bandwidth and time and money. The scenes in the house are actually my house, which is a historic house in Druid Hills neighborhood of Atlanta, called the Boxwood. So that was lucky that I had a, you know, a really nice old house to shoot there. And then in the garden in the back. And we had also wanted to film some scenes on the Chattahoochee. And what we ended up doing is, my brother is a drone photographer, and he got some really nice drone shots of the city and then also of the Chattahoochee River, which you kind of put into the end. So that kind of saved on that. The other scenes were, you know, because I have an expert witness, I was able to get the attorneys I work with. And then they're more, you know, willing to be malleable because they need me. Their expert witness, you know, so a lot of the scenes were shot in the Warshauer law firm. So all the scenes were there, you know, the corporate meeting with that really nice glass table and the painting behind. A lot of the meetings were it's like his office at the hospital was actually office in this law firm. So there's a law firm with like 20 rooms, you know, meeting rooms, plus there's a room with boxes of legal documents. So everything just sort of fit in nicely with that. And then a lot of it was, you know, we just asked my son, who's 27, just give us a list of iconic spots in Georgia, in Atlanta. And so we went around with Jim on one day and got some fixed shots of those spots. And then my brother did some other drone photography. So that's where all the nice shots of the bridge. There's sort of an iconic place that people, you know, you see it in The Walking Dead. People like to take the shots from that bridge that's near the Martin Luther King Park, that's looking down the freeway towards the city of Atlanta. And then we got some other ones that are up on the I-75 from some of the bridges, like 20th Street Bridge, looking back, you know, at the city of Atlanta. And then originally there was sort of this theme of rivers that kind of got basically cut out, but then the freeway was supposed to be kind of like a river, you know, because there's so many cars on the freeway, it looks like a river. And then some of the other, there's a lot of really nice visuals in Atlanta, this sort of urban artwork, you know, murals and stuff like that. And so we kind of sliced in some of those things. But a lot of it was just sort of, you know, a place like the Beltline in Atlanta and the urban, you know, murals and stuff. I had sort of been scouting that out in my mind, you know, and talking with Jim about it and stuff in advance. And then the Marriott was, how did we get to the Marriott? I don't really remember. It was, well, because actually I did a medical conference there. So it was like perfect, you know, because I actually had my own like kind of educational conference business for about a year that I gave up on, but we did do a medical conference there. And so in my mind, I was like, this is the perfect place. And so Jim and I would, they had a little restaurant there. We'd meet and have a beer, you know, and kind of walk around, look at things and stuff. So that was where all the medical meetings were and medical conferences and stuff like that, which it was kind of a challenge because we had to make it look like there's multiple medical conferences. You know what I mean? So we used the main podium for one conference, and then we kind of turned it around and then made our own kind of fake podium on the back of the room, you know, to make it look like it was a different day, you know, stuff like that. And that all, I think, worked out pretty well. That was sort of an anxiety that I had. That we weren't going to, you know, make it look like we're always in the same place. But I think that worked out.
I'm looking at all of these locations that you have, and you really varied things up beautifully. We fully have the sense that we're in different offices, different meeting rooms, different locales. So you did a great job with that. But all of that, putting that package together, falls on your editor, on Christina Cromer, Were you in the editing bay with poor Christina, putting all this together to give us this great sense of the vastness of the area and putting us, immersing us?
Yeah, so another thing is that the medical scenes were, I have a friend who has his own business. He does like recovery of toxic material, so he has kind of like lab type stuff. So a lot of the medical stuff is in there. So I was able to kind of, you know, use my French, I guess, if you will, to be able to use that space. But so Christina did a great job. She did the first pass, you know, and then she did the first pass, and then they have the, you know, kind of like the, they have a term for it. It's like the music, but it's not like going to be the final music, you know.
Oh, kind temp. She was using a temp track.
Temp track. I really like the temp track, actually, but anyway, so she did that, and then I then went in with her, and then with Jim, the cinematographer, and Travis Preston, who was the post supervisor, and we, they have a, you know, a studio, it's called Moonshine Productions, and so we went in there and spent several days going over things with her, and modifying things, and then the and then we came back with the colorist, is John Peterson, who I had worked with him on our first film, so he's sort of a friend, you know. So these are all local people, but you know, they're all really good, you know. Like I think John worked on you know, some of these Airplane 2 kind of movies and stuff like that, so they've you know, they get a tax credit, you know, if they use local people. So yep. You know, they get these kind of jobs as well.
How long did it take to edit this film? And at what point, you liked your temp track, but you had to get a real, you had to get your own score going here. So at what point did you get a score from Evan Hodges to put into your final edit for your final product?
Yeah, so we did the whole thing. So like we did the primary production over, I think it was 21 or 24 days in October, November, and then they got started, you know, pretty much right away, and that went on, the editing went up through maybe March of, so the 2025, and then Evan worked on it for about maybe 6 to 8 weeks, so he took the you know, the actual film, you know, kind of the final cut of the film,
right,
with the temp track, and then he just sort of substituted where the temp tracks were, you know, for his own proposing, and then I went back and forth, you know, with him quite a bit. So that was just really me and him, and it was mainly like, you know, his composing is really good, so I'm not a musician, so it was really more like me sort of saying, you know, this is an angry scene, or you know, something like that. Yeah. You know, kind of keep trying to convey like exactly what I thought the emotion would be. And he was, you know, I can't imagine doing a job like that where you're just getting, I mean, I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't take the criticism very well, but that's what he does, you know, so he's used to it. So he was fine with that. And then there's this, Dave Wilson did post sound production, and he put in a lot of the kind of the special effects and stuff like that, you know, and he brought in the actors for, you know, when they re-record.
Yeah, for the ADR, for ADR, yeah.
ADR, yeah, yeah. So, and I came in for those sessions with them, and they did that, and, you know, so he was he works a lot with, his main thing is doing ADR with the studio films like Marvel and stuff like that, where Marvel will come in. Well, they used to come into Georgia. They kind of moved on to Europe now, but they used to come into Georgia and film, and then the actors would come from LA. Then when they went home, then his job was to sort of hook up with them, you know, on whatever, online or whatever, however he does it, and do the ADR with them from LA. That's sort of a big part of what he does. But I knew him from my first film, so I was kind of friends with him too. And so he, you know, he was able to do this. He doesn't usually work on films like this, and he did a lot more than what he usually does which is, you know, he's usually just more of an ADR guy, but he did a lot of the kind of, what do you call the
mix?
For, yeah, the mix, and then the Foleys, I think they call it.
Okay, yeah, the Foley, yeah. Where,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had all that, he had the whole library of that, and so he was able to do that, you know, like the footsteps or whatever, the stuff he did. And then he re-recorded some of the, he recorded some of the stuff, like where the main character is driving in his car, and then he's mm-hmm. listening to the radio. That was actually me. There's a point where it was me talking, but I was talking like I was on a podcast about like the research that I do, you know?
Yeah.
I was talking about neuromodulation or something like that. And then it was his idea to sort of have some of the internal, his thoughts being like Crystal, all the negative things that Crystal was saying, like, you know, doctor, did you, why did you do that? You know? And so that was, we had, as I remember, Nisi sort of record some of those things in the studio with Dave, and then and that became his internal, you know, sort of internal monologue, I guess.
And it worked, it worked really well, Doug, doing that. And you probably know this from your own experience testifying in things. You second guess yourself all the time, and you replay it in your mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and then it becomes like a criticism, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, yeah. 80% of these experts get thrown out. And we're talking about these are like the leaders of their field, and 80% of the time they're excluded. Just because you have super sharp defense attorneys.
Over the years, it gets more and more difficult to qualify experts in some of these more high-profile cases. You know, just because of technology, just because experts, they have to stay at the top of their game. They have to be at the top of technology and research. And hopefully you can find people that aren't in somebody's pocket. And that's the hard part. How difficult was the casting for this film? Andy Evans is wonderful as Dr. Forteo. He comes across as sympathetic. He comes across as very academic. Doesn't have the best people skills because he is more of an academic and researcher.
Right,
but
right.
Andy is wonderful as Forteo. And Hannah as Amanda Bellaconda is just fantastic. And as I'd mentioned before, David DeVries as Red Leghorn. How difficult was the casting process for you?
Well, we had sort of a false start about 6 years ago where I had a casting director who originally came from L.A. who lined up a lot of the people, but then, you know, when you had this time gap, then a lot of the people drop off, and I think most of the people kind of assumed that it wouldn't, it wasn't going to go forward. So, and then I was trying to fill in people from the Southeast to save on the budget in terms of the travel
mm-hmm.
costs. And then when you get into people that are, you know, kind of at a higher level, then you get into things like you basically have to start using, you know, beauty wagons and Teamsters and stuff. You know, so some of the people have been cast in the first round, and like Sean Sharma, who played the Ryan Singh, he mm-hmm. actually was in the original group of people cast, and he read the book and he really got into the story and everything, so he really wanted to do it. David DeVries had done audiobooks for my wife, who's also an academic researcher, and so she knew him, and so I was able to just sort of just go directly to him, and he just, when he saw the script, he said, oh, I got this is like a no-brainer for me, I know this character. So that was really good. Some of the other ones, I spent a lot of time looking at demo reels on like backstage.com
mm-hmm.
and just sort of trying to find people. So Carolyn Granger, who was the wife, she was in my first film. So that was sort of a no-brainer. I already knew her well, and she was a solid entity. I knew that she wouldn't mess up. Hannah was friends with this guy who was a producer originally on the 5 years ago, but then kind of dropped by the wayside. But she's from Atlanta originally, and so she knew him. And then one of the producers that came on kind of the last minute was friends with her, so she already knew people just from, you know, being an Atlanta person. And she's sort of like the most well-known actress. You know, she was in this VHS and stuff like that. So she's like really super solid, you know, so you can kind of count on her. So the Andy was, you know, that was kind of a stretch because he's mainly like a character actor, who plays like, you know, he hasn't played a lot of roles like this, but the thing I liked about him is he sort of had an irony about him and a kind of an intelligence, but he was also sort of a vulnerable. So I didn't want like, you know, a Brad Pitt type that would come in and kind of hit over the head and
yeah,
super strong, you know, superhero thing. I wanted this to be like a reluctant hero, someone who kind of gets into it, not because they're trying to fly their own flag or be an advocate, but it's like an accidental thing. Cause that's how it works in real life. You know, you don't just, I'm going to go out and be an advocate for drug safety. You know, you sort of do your little research and then you get capped and then you basically have no idea like what a shit storm you're flying into. Whereas everybody else knows.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so probably chuckling at you behind your back.
Yeah. Andy did give Dr. Forteo kind of a deer in headlights almost. Because he wasn't sure what he was getting into and he had so much trepidation and you could tell. He may understand everything about psychiatric brain studies and MRIs and CT scans and comparing data, but stepping in and saying, oh, yeah, I'll do a study. Oh, yeah, okay, after he finally gets convinced. And you could tell, deer in headlights, he had no clue, and then it's like, what have I gotten myself into? But the entire time, he is so sympathetic that you really feel for him and you're rooting for him. Because this film, Doug, I got to tell you, we've seen lots of medical films before. We've seen series. We've seen things like Dope Sick that I know David was in. He played a lawyer in that. But nothing focuses on the expert witness. It's always the lawyers or the client, the plaintiff, the defendant, but not the expert. So this is a really unique take that people haven't seen before. I think you cast Andy perfectly in this role for this to be probably one of the first exposures people will have to a story told from this perspective, from this POV. So I think you really did a great job there with the casting.
That's good. You know, we were, you know, because he's not like a super kind of superhero figure, you know, I think that we're, and he's more kind of, you know, subtle. You know, we were like a little bit worried. You know, he was sort of a stretch, you know, but I picked him myself, you know, so, you know, I think it worked out. And it was sort of like, it was trying to aim for that reluctant hero, not superhero kind of character that is more like the reality of what it's like to be a, you know, to be an expert witness. Because, you know, the plaintiff's attorneys, you know, if they're really good at it, you know, my sister's an attorney and she's won some big cases and stuff. And I kind of know what it's like. And the good ones are competent, right? I mean,
yep. 'Cause
they've won before, you know, they know they can do it again. They're kind of like advocates for justice or whatever. But like, if you're an expert witness, you're often coming into something totally cold.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that world, you know, it's foreign. You tend to like, you know, when you get deposed, you end up talking too much or showing too much emotion or whatever it is, because these lawyers, you know, are really good at trying to make you look bad, basically.
Mm-hmm. That's...
So I'm glad that he fits, because it's sort of a, you know, it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't going to be, you know, it's like when you look at someone like Hannah Fuhrman, you know, it's like, you know what you got, right? I mean, it's...
Yes, absolutely.
You don't need any coaching. Although the interesting thing about her is that I would give her points, and she would kind of look like she was like, why are you talking to me? And then she would go out and do it, you know?
That's hilarious. Doug, you have done a great job with this film. As I just said, I love this perspective that we see this through the eyes of the expert witness, the expert doctor, and his considerations. And it is unique perspective in film and television.
Yeah, but you know, most of the medical dramas you see are written by people that are not, they don't have any healthcare background.
So that's right.
It's on someone else. It's sort of like they focus on like the doctor and the nurse making out in the stairwell and stuff like that, you know? I think The Pitt, I watched a few episodes of The Pitt. The Pitt does a pretty good job of kind of conveying, you know, what it's like to be in an ER. I don't really know anything about who did that. But, you know, a lot of, like, there, it's like, yeah, so the and then in terms of the courtroom dramas, it's like, yeah, it's focused on the lawyers and the, you know, maybe like a victim or something like that. The Blackwater did a pretty good, I kind of look at that a lot.
Yeah.
And in our, what we call the lookbook, where you sort of, before we filmed, we were trying to show what the movie would be like. We had a bunch of the pictures of Mark Buffalo because he was like an attorney who was, you know, trying to litigate against Dow Chemical for these forever chemicals. And it was more realistic in that it just dragged on for years. And in the end, there was like no real resolution. You know, sort of like, and that was another problem that we had with this one is because, you know, in real life, the people all settled and they part of the settlement was that they couldn't talk about it. So I didn't even know that they had settled until I went back and tried to get a hold of the lawyers to try to get them to invest in this film. And they would never take any of my phone calls. I called one of them like 21 times, you know, and finally one of them, one of the guys who was sort of personally involved answered and he told me like what happened, that they all settled. And then I was trying to get the guy who had donated the money for the research originally, he was from Ireland, he was, blew me off. And then when he saw that we actually made the film, he kind of came back and, you know, guiltily told me, hey, I actually settled. Which is so weird because he was like this big advocate and negative, you know, about the Roche drug company. And there's a doc online called Skin to Die For that he's in where he's talking about how he's going to take on Roche and all this stuff. And then in the end, he said, well, if I had not settled with them, I could have been out $1 million in lawyer fees or something. But he had been actually in the script originally, but he wasn't a very sympathetic character. So as I was, you know, cutting down the script and trying to make it, you know, more streamlined, he just came out altogether.
Yeah, sometimes you got to cut them out, especially if they're not sympathetic, yeah. Because you already have non-sympathetic people in this film. You have you have the defense lawyers and the university and the hospital people. They're not sympathetic.
Yeah, and he was like a not sympathetic in kind of a wishy-washy way, you know. So I had him say, you know, sort of like say a biblical verse at the end or something, and it was just like, oh. Just we don't. He's not necessary. You know. He can go. But you know. And then the character, like the DC Woods character, you know, she just really. You know, I told her like, you know, the bad guy is the most important character in the film. You know, so she really sunk her teeth into that and you know, reveled. I've seen actors who, you know, complain that their character wasn't sympathetic and stuff like that in the past, but for her it was like, you know, she got it. Yeah. Right away, and didn't need, you know, needed minimal coaching or no coaching really, because she just knew, you know, knew what to do. David said that he played an unlikable lawyer in the Dope Sick.
Yeah, David was a lawyer in Dope Sick. I think he was a lawyer in something else too, but I remember him from Dope Sick.
I think he described it as like he played the sleazebag lawyer or something.
But David has that quality to him. And even though Red Leghorn, he's a plaintiff's attorney here. He's representing Hannah, representing Amanda in the death of her son. The fast talking and that down home aw shucks. It also, it's kind of not a straight up thing. It's a slant.
Exactly. Yeah.
So he's very good at that.
Yeah.
He's very good at that. In other projects that he's been in that I've seen him in, yeah, he's really good at things like that. So you really lucked out. with your casting here, I've got to tell you.
That's the other aspect of this, is it like the expert witness is like a sacrificial lamb. You
know? Yes,
they're
absolutely
risking their career, and they have no idea. They're just sort of thrown in there, and it's like, guard them, you know. You're the expert, beltlet, crystal, you know.
Then that's pretty much what you tell your experts. If they're getting cold feet, or if they're getting concerned, or if they're getting angry because they're being attacked, and it's like, this is the job of opposing counsel. This is their job. Do not let it get to you. Of course, that's easier said than done.
Absolutely. And it's like, and then it's not only just that they're being criticized on the stand, it's like their research
is being questioned.
They literally subpoenaed all the research and looked for all the errors, you know. So then you're like, oh, shit, you know, they're going to find these errors and make me retract, you know, which is what they tried to do. You know, they tried to, they went to the journal and asked them to retract it. Well, that's actually in the movie.
Medical experts and scientific experts, they have a lot at stake when they have published papers out there or books out there. Or they're running studies, conducting studies. There is so much to nitpick and pull apart. That's what you got to do, no matter what side of the fence you're on. But
And when I wrote the, you know, I write backstories of the characters, and so when I wrote the backstory for Crystal, and I said that she'd been raised by a single mom, and that her father was an alcoholic that he couldn't be counted on, and they never knew if they're going to have enough food on the table. So then she goes and gets a dual degree in law and, you know, pharmacology or whatever, and she's like, she promised herself she's never going to get into that situation again. So that's where she's coming from. And so now she's like working for this pharmaceutical company, and she's sort of, in her mind, she's sort of fighting the trailer trash that she came from,
yeah,
to prevent them from getting the big payout that is not warranted. And I think these people really believe that, you know, their drug is fine, and, you know, because it's just sort of a confirmation bias or a groupthink where they're all on one team, you know, and that's the way they look at it. And, you know, I have enough experience, you know, in being an expert that I could see into the mind of the defense attorney and what they, you know, like that one of the attorneys would say, the defense attorney would say, I could judge a person whether they're an alcoholic just by looking at their shoes.
Yeah.
It's like so judgmental, you know, but it's just like shows in their mind, you know, the way that.
Now, unfortunately, I have to move on to another interview that's coming through in the next 3 minutes. This has been a joy getting to speak with you, Doug, about The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg. Do you know offhand when it's screening at Dances with Films?
It's June 27th at 3:45 p.m. It's in Theater 4, but all the theaters are in that complex.
Yeah, they're all in the Mans. They're all upstairs, 6 theaters up there. It's a great complex. Great complex.
Yeah.
Doug, I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk with me about this and for making the film. I mean, it's an eye-opening film. It's an eye-opening film for people. And as I said, I love the perspective that this one has. It's not one that we see. It's original. It's important. And go make a third film. You've only done two. You know, I'm sure you can find another topic to make a film about.
Well, I have like 11 screenplays. They're all about doctors, usually.
Doug, thank you so, so much. And hopefully we'll chat again in the future.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Bye-bye. And that was doctor and director and writer Doug Bremner talking about The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg. And you can see The Goose That Laid the Golden Egg when it has its premiere at Dances with Films on June 27th at 3:45 p.m. So check it out. As I said, unique perspective, interesting. You're never bored. You get connected to these characters. Very well done film. And I can't wait to see. Doug has 11 scripts that he's written. I'd like to see him get a move on with some of those and, you know, with each one grow as a filmmaker to match his medical expertise. So that is all the time we have today. And then some. We went way, 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 way over today. If you're in LA, make sure to head to Hollywood, check out these films and others at Dances with Films. And mark your calendars for Friday, June 24th, when Rod Lurie's latest film... It's the 26th. I'm an idiot. My embargo lifts on the 24th. The film is out in theaters. Friday, June 26th, Lucky Strike, starring Scott Eastwood. I love this collaborative work between Rod and Scott. As you'll recall, they did The Outpost together a few years ago. But this one, Lucky Strike, is set during World War II and the Battle of the Bulge that occurred over Christmas. This is a film not to be missed. It is a piece of history that I think everybody, especially this the younger generation now, should learn about, should watch, should Google about. And the great thing about World War II is that evil, good and evil, it's like in the old days of the West. There are two very distinct sides. You know who's good. You know who's evil. Allies were good. Nazis evil. No question there. So it makes it a lot easier watching a film like this that has brutality in it, that has blood, that has action, and that looks at a piece of history, because the lines are very clear cut. And it's an incredible film. But you're going to find my review and my interview with Rod later this week after my embargo lifts on the 24th. And I can't wait to share all of that with you. But now, in the interim, you know, I'll be back next week with more interviews and more films to talk about. But make sure to check out BehindTheLensOnline.net. There's plenty of new interviews and reviews up there. I'm popping them out with greater frequency of late. So there's always something new for you. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.